Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I am an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. In today's episode, Mindy Jane Roseman, SRHM associate editor, director of the International Law Program at Yale University School of Law, and director of the Gruber Program for Global Justice and Women's Rights, is speaking with Dr. Martin Smeetana, research associate in the Reproductive Sociology Research Group at Cambridge University, and Sarojini Nadimpalli, founder of Sama Resource Group for Women and Health and the former co-chair of the People's Health Movement Global. Together, they discuss the evolution and complexities of surrogacy worldwide. They explore how surrogacy is viewed in different areas of the world, how laws vary, and how to frame the issue from a reproductive rights perspective. This episode builds on an article co-authored by Martin entitled Moral Frameworks of Commercial Surrogacy Within the U.S., India, and Russia, which was published in the SRHM Journal last spring. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to this SRHM podcast on surrogacy. My name is Mindy Jane Roseman, and I will be moderating with our two fantastic participants here, Sarojini and Martin. Briefly, surrogacy over the last few years has moved from the margins of sexual and reproductive health more towards the center, and it really cuts across all of the issues that constitute the field of sexual and reproductive health. It brings together biomedical interventions through law and policy that speak to issues and assumptions around gender, sexuality, and reproduction. And it is increasingly at the forefront of family formation. SRHM has been publishing some of the most productive articles on surrogacy. And it's with that in mind that we've organized this podcast. So we're just going to start with a question to Martin. If you could tell us briefly, what is surrogacy?
Hello, thank you. Perhaps a very brief definition would be a practice where a woman, the surrogate or surrogate mother, carries a baby for another intended parent. So the surrogate can use her own genetic material, and in that case, it's called traditional surrogacy, or in the UK, host surrogacy, or a separate egg donor may be involved, which is in practice called gestational surrogacy.
We know that states regulate the formation of families, whether or not any kind of technologies such as assisted reproductive technologies are used. Are there different ethical and human rights frameworks that should be used when we're talking about surrogacy, or should the regular, ordinary frameworks that inform the family law, for example, be used? Sarojini, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm just talking definitely from the Indian situation, but also the way the debates, the way they range between the absolute violation of these rights by the commercial interests on the one hand, and the assertion of rights over the body as a resource on the other. Similar is the conflict between the very patriarchal concept of biological lineage and a marginalized but commercial recognition of reproductive labor of at least some women by the same structures of patriarchy. So there are no easy answers in such a situation, but it is important for us to evaluate our responses with honest answers to difficult questions like whose reproductive and sexual rights, what kind of choice, how do we articulate, protect the most marginalized, how do we stay distinct from the growing conservative and moralistic voices of the vast majority that defends the very basic of both heteropatriarchy and globalized capitalism. How do we reduce the vulnerability of the most dispossessed in these transactions? So any framework which is going to talk about the rights here in the context of surrogacy should address all these issues.
That is so interesting what you say. What I hear is that the practice of surrogacy exposes all of the assumptions and underpinnings that constitute what we consider a family and makes quite visible the ethical and rights that are at stake and the other systems that they engage with, such as market forces and the need to really be coherent and well-grounded in human rights to come up with a coherent approach to surrogacy. Marcin, I'm wondering if both you and Sarojini have any reflections on the ways that states do in fact regulate the practices of surrogacy and what they get right and what they get wrong.
It's a very good question. And I think to answer it, we should first try to think about those ethical frameworks that we would suggest are right for surrogacy, such as what Sarojini has just started talking about. And I would just add to this that perhaps one of the most powerful frameworks that I have been arguing for with my colleagues is the one of reproductive justice. And we started that work with my colleagues Karis Thompson and Franz Windens-Twine in a special issue that we published in 2018. And then we actually continued this work with Sharmila Rudrapa, Christina Weiss in the paper that we published here in the Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters. So reproductive justice, this is a question because reproductive justice comes from the framework of the United States, from the communities of women of color. We argued that what reproductive justice could help do in surrogacy would take into account and protect the interests of all participants, so surrogates, egg donors, and intended parents, and this at the same time, so not privileging only the side of the intended parents, for example, which happens a lot, right? And then also examining inequalities involved in surrogacy, class, race, gender, sexuality, and others. And now different countries answering our questions have been doing it, different jurisdictions, legislators have been doing it in different ways. For example, in the paper that I mentioned that we published in the journal here, we analyzed three of those frameworks. We looked at California, then at Western Russia, St. Petersburg, and then Southern India, Karnataka. And so we saw that in each region, the surrogates and parents used some normative cultural frameworks, local cultural frameworks, through which they understood surrogacy, which also, of course, had legal implications, but it was much more than the legal. It was also cultural understandings of surrogacy. And of course, there isn't one ideal framework. It's difficult to say because, for example, in the United States, surrogacy was understood through this notion of relationships as well as commodity exchange. In India, the industry understood it mainly through the notion of kind of a business exchange. That's how the industry understood it, while the, and Sarojini, I'm sure, may say more about it. Whereas under that framework, it was still the commercial transnational surrogacy framework in India. The surrogate mothers didn't have too much of a voice. But in Russia, the framework was very much of a business exchange. So answering your question, so it is a little broader than just the state regulation. It is also the local cultural framework. And I think a very interesting case in point is also the UK, where there's the framework of altruistic surrogacy. It works in that context, right? So my proposition would be probably to try and apply the reproductive justice framework and have the voices of all participants involved somehow respected in all those contexts. But of course, as we also found in our paper, it is very contextual, right? So it is very difficult to talk about one possible answer. And I'm sure that Sarojini can add quite a lot to this.
Yes, Marcin, before we turn to Sarojini, I just want to ask you, is there any state that you know of that gets it right, that uses a reproductive justice framework in regulating surrogacy?
The UK is, I would suggest, quite close to this, because thanks to its community-based framework of surrogacy, there is a lot of space for negotiation between surrogates, egg donors if they're involved, and intended parents. So there's a very strong surrogacy community, which helps structure the process in a way that the voices of everyone respected. The community gives a lot of support to it. Now, of course, there is the current legal reform of surrogacy in the UK, and it is again under discussion to see if this could be even fairer, because there are some controversial issues, such as where the parental rights should be relinquished by the surrogate, right? currently in the UK, this is after birth only. And this is from the viewpoint of reproductive justice. This could be right because the surrogate has a right to change her mind, which happens very little, but she has. While actually the surrogacy community and surrogates themselves in the UK are actually campaigning for giving this right and the parental orders to intended parents earlier so that they aren't worried either about being left with the babies, right? So it is very difficult to take the framework and then measure the context against it in some way, because then we can see that in a specific context, there are so many voices and a debate is framed in such a specific way. The United States are a very interesting case as well, where there are relationships between surrogates and parents. There is some negotiation power on their part as well. But then the intended parents actually do end up having the final say because they have the bargaining power and they pay.
Okay, Sarah Jeannie, over to you. What do states get right and what do they get wrong when they start to regulate surrogacy, in your opinion?
For me, rights are fairly contextual. What seems like only violation in one context can also be interpreted as the best possible option in another. So our fear of reinforcement of what we are arguing about, the genetic parenting and parenting per se, cannot be articulated only in the context of the assisted reproductive technology and surrogacy. It's a fear that exists in every heterosexual marriage that tries to make sure that the right kinds of children are born to the right kind of people in the right way. So our oppression is also how women being pushed into more risky, marginal, informal labor and how it have grave concerns on their unpaid labor, what they do. So that is one aspect. Coming back to the regulation, and I just wanted to add a couple of points here. I can give an example from India. We have separated surrogacy from the Assisted Reproductive Technology Bill in 2016. So we have two different bills. One is regulating assisted reproductive technologies independent of surrogacy. We have surrogacy regulation bill. So both the bills are still pending. So there are only Indian Council of Medical Research guidelines, which are not statutory. So we have a bill now on surrogacy, which allows for altruistic surrogacy only to married Indian couples and widows, it called, or divorcees, and disqualifying others on the grounds of marital status, age, sexual orientation, and nationality. That impinges upon the right to equality for being an unreasonable classification. So by banning commercial surrogacy, the bill does not take into account this intersectional aspect of how the law would impact women's right to their bodies. So the altruistic model expects a woman to go through the physical and emotional tolls of surrogacy free of cost and only out of compassion. That is the word they use. Such an expectation is paternalistic, unrealistic, and patriarchal. That is what we were questioning. So this, in turn, limits the number of women willing to go through surrogacy and indirectly denies intending parents the, I put it in quotes, of course, the opportunity to avail it. So the bill is based on of marriage by allowing only married couples. And which is again, you know, we do have Article 14 of the Constitution of India, which says, you know, the use of any person in the provision ensures that the benefit of Article 14 is not confined to citizens alone, but is available to any person within the territory of India. So, but bill only allows an Indian citizen be a part of it, and it does not permit foreigners anyway from 2013 onwards. And it does, it also, we had to question, because it is against the striking down of Section 377 of Indian Constitution by the Supreme Court, which decriminalized the consensual sexual relations between two adults of any sexuality. So the bill denies the rights of homosexual couples to commission a child and refuses to acknowledge these couples. So there are many, many issues which we need to also talk when we are talking about a comprehensive legal framework for the regulation. These aspects need to be looked into along with the what exactly the Constitution has guaranteed. That is very important.
Thank you, Sarah Jeannie. That, again, raises more questions than it answers in terms of the promise or the liberation that surrogacy can bring in terms of gender and sexuality, the ways in which it can make quite strange and beautiful how a family is constituted, and conversely, the way that certain states may approach surrogacy and try to stabilize the family formation so that it resembles the patriarchal, heteronormative family and excludes all other kinds of not only diverse families, but constrains the way that individuals can provide services to create those families. I think it's very interesting. I just wanted to add one observation that I've seen in studying the ways in which states have regulated surrogacy, and that's in turning to their criminal codes and criminalization and trying to conflate surrogacy, particularly when compensated, with the sale of children or the trafficking of children or the exploitation of persons who provide surrogacy services, which certainly in the transnational and international space, just because of the prominence of the prohibition on the sales of children and concern about exploitation and trafficking of women, really comes to the fore. And it is quite a point of concern how that gets translated into international laws and perhaps will be reflected in future international regulation. I'd like to turn now to the very broad question, but the real grounded experiences of all people involved in surrogacy, intended parents, whether they're gay or straight, married or single, of the gestational surrogates, of third parties such as agencies and health and medical professionals, and of the children born from surrogacy arrangements. Can you tell us anything about the empirical experiences that people have, whether it's with recruitment or the details of the arrangements, the relinquishment of those people born from surrogacy, and the kinds of sexual and reproductive health and rights frames and reproductive justice frames? What can you share with us about your observations?
I would say also drawing on the paper that we published in the SRHM with Sharmila Rudrapa and Christina Weiss, experiences depend on the context. So in the US surrogacy, the parties usually experienced surrogacy as a relationship at the same time as they experienced it as a commercial exchange. While in India and Russia, they mainly experienced it as a commercial exchange, even though Sharmila's research in India showed that the surrogates actually wanted to experience it as something more, but the industry silenced them in some way. And in general, I would say intended parents' experiences are positive, even though they face a lot of economic and other barriers. So also returning to the reproductive justice viewpoint, again, if we ever try to apply the reproductive justice framework to surrogacy, it opens this path to parenthood to some groups that couldn't access it before, such as gay people. But of course, only to the wealthiest ones, right? So there is an experience of struggling with the resources. For example, among my own interviewees were mainly gay men accessing surrogacy. It is also very energy consuming, taxing. But all in all, of course, some parents also discovered they suffer from infertility. Miscarriages happen in surrogacy. In case of gay parents, they also have some thoughts about stigmatization that they might suffer as families. But overall, their experiences are positive and they are the commissioning part in surrogacy, especially in commercial surrogacy. And they have more freedom to decide if they do possess the resources to do this. On the other hand, surrogates' experiences, I think, vary. They all follow a very strict medical routine of clinical labor, emotional labor. As I said, depending on the context, they might have more power to negotiate or not. They normally adapt to the requirements of the industry. Some do this for a price, and some do suffer negative consequences. In all our country cases, we found that some surrogates had some issues with medical insurance post-birth, for example. So this is something that should be taken care of. And that's where reproductive justice framework, I think, enters. also some surrogates had to contend with the intended parent's decision not to maintain close relationships while they would like to do so, for example, in the United States, as the framework, the cultural framework, as we call it, the moral framework of surrogacy is maintaining relationships in the United States, contrary to Russia, for example. If the intended parents cut ties with surrogates, and it happened in very few cases, it was a minority of cases, but still this was something that the surrogates had to accept, even though they didn't quite like it. Right? Overall, the experiences were generally positive, but as I said, there is a cost that surrogates pay for this.
A lot to think about. But let's turn to the situation in the media and the way that sensationalized stories often drive people's emotions and influence culture and travel globally, where practice may be in one state, which may make sense, as you're saying, is, you know, deeply contextualized, may be fodder for a sensational news story somewhere else. How do you see this influencing at all the practice of surrogacy? What suggestions might you have for addressing these sensationalized stories?
So again, from my research and the research with colleagues, I think those sensational cases are a minority of cases. However, they do reveal issues existent in surrogacy. They do reveal power imbalances, for example, which are lesser or greater depending on the surrogacy model. And again, I think that trying to apply a perspective where every participant's needs and voices are listened to and respected could be a way forward in this case.
I was thinking specifically, or most recently, during COVID, when there were babies born to surrogates and the intended parents weren't able to travel and so on. It once again became sort of, at least the transnational practice became somehow a bit in the public's eye and definitely a site where people threw all kinds of judgments out there.
Even here, you know, we came across many news articles. In fact, I just started writing a piece on that in some of the states in the Western province, like, you know, the pretending couple could not come due to the lockdown during COVID. There was a strict lockdown. They were not allowed to travel and the children were born. And it became like a major issue because how do you, in the breastfeeding period extended, and the surrogates were also not very sure what is going to happen to them in the long run, because many of the clinics were not able to hand over the babies to the intended parents. So it is an issue actually, which is very important to look in the context of pandemics, how this not only international surrogacy, but even intra, because you cannot travel from one state to the other. So that became a big issue. But I think what is very important, you know, in the context of, unless, you know, we recognize the availing surrogacy is as a reproductive rights issue and a reproductive justice issue, just having a bill or a regulatory framework will not be able to, I put it like, you know, protect the bodily autonomy of the surrogate and the right to the parenthood of the intending parents and including the rights of the children. So that is something which we need to start thinking about it. Definitely, what kind of human rights framework we want to apply here? Definitely, some of the principles which are there in the human rights framework are applicable. Right to privacy, right to confidentiality, I said in the beginning, right to autonomy. And also, you know, it's going with our own constitutional rights for equity and equality. So unless those principles, even certain ethical norms and feminist ethos, if they are not there in any legislation or in any framework, it will be, I feel, very inadequate. And also it will be like a black spot, I feel. So the notion of equality or equity will not be there unless we address these from a human rights framework. And there are possibilities and there is an opportunity for us to, you know, come up with that kind of framework, because What we have seen in other countries, for example, like I was listening to a friend in Cambodia, the criminalization of the surrogates, or in many places, this is also happening. The terminology is also emerging, you know, which is very important to understand what do we mean by criminalization, which is equally important to address when we are coming up with any human rights framework.
So I'm going to just ask each of you if there's anything that you weren't able to discuss during this conversation that you'd like to bring up that you think is critically important to surrogacy in the context of sexual reproductive health and reproductive justice. Marcin, let's start with you.
Thank you. I would add that it is very interesting and very visible over the last decade or two that surrogacy has been increasingly used by the gay community, by gay men, and that it has somehow made thinkable to gay men, or at least to those gay men who can afford it, and perhaps also to some trans people, surrogacy has made it thinkable to them and possible to them to imagine a family form, often with their same-sex partner, with children that are genetically related to the fathers or to each other. And its importance is growing. For example, recent research in the UK has found the use of surrogacy has quadrupled over the last decade, and up to a half of intended parents are gay men. Same in the United States. It has risen 3 or 4 times over the last decade. I have also found that for some of my younger interviews, surrogacy is option A, as they said. So in a way, this recreates a traditional family form, but at the same time, it also changes it. Right. Laura Mamo used this term queering reproduction when she talked about lesbian women using donor conception. That, of course, people are drawing here on some traditional repertoire, but at the same time, they are doing something new. And they are doing it also for many reasons, such as fear of marginalization, because especially in case of gay men in some countries, such as Italy, for example, where a gay man can't adopt children, single people can't adopt children, the only basis for them to be recognized is the genetic link, right? So if they can afford it, they pursue transnational commercial surrogacy. And interestingly, the mainstream gay community in some countries, such as the United States or the UK, has endorsed surrogacy as a path of family formation. And one interesting example are such grassroots organizations such as Our Family Coalition in San Francisco, for example, which has allied with the US gay surrogacy organizations. So this is, I think, something that I wanted to add to somehow flag the specific situation of the gay community.
Is there anything in particular that you would like to...
Yes. See, it is very, very important to talk for me. It is important to speak the entire surrogacy from the reproductive justice framework. And now there are newer discourses coming. I'm sure both of you are familiar. My other is from the labor work framework. You know, that is something which is coming up, like surrogates are the workers. So workers' rights framework following the ILO, the certain clauses in that. And the labor, or, you know, from that point, the reproductive justice has been addressed very recently. And many people are talking about, you know, surrogacy. If you don't address from the workers' rights point of view, it will be incomplete. So it is quite interesting how things are emerging in the entire reproductive justice framework. One is talking about the labor conditions for the workers, which where surrogates are seen as workers. And their rights as surrogate mothers. That is one, I don't want to say debate, but it is coming very dominantly in our context too. For me, I think it's important. It's quite interesting, in fact, for us in India, like, you know, I just mentioned about Section 377 and the consequences, and then it is very clearly a heteronormative framework. So the question of access to queer community, which is completely missing in the entire regulatory framework. So that is something very, very clear here, which is again something which we need to all, you know, we are also demanding. What do we mean by reproductive justice? What do we mean by equity? What do we mean by intersectionality? If we are not talking about the rights of everyone, including, you know, but it is also very important to address. It's when we say equity, it's very different, you know, a homosexual couple talking about agency and equity is very different from the heterosexual couple. It is given for them. So that is where we need to understand the patriarchal and other biases or the moral frameworks which exist and the legal frameworks which exist, which will completely deny the right to the homosexual couples. I think that is somewhere we need to also talk about the privileges which we have, the heteronormative, the heterosexual couples, why we don't talk about, you know, the equity in the context of transgender and LGBTQI couples. So that is something which is very important. The framework should look into that, the privileges.
Thank you both. I wish we had so much more time to explore all the dimensions of the practices of surrogacy, to be able to discuss the various terms that we use, the various ways in which different individuals and communities have access to health and health technology and all the disparities and inequalities there, let alone the information and ability to form families in the ways that they want to and be enabled by the state and by the international human rights frameworks. So again, thank you both. Perhaps we continue this at a later date.
Thank you to Mindy Jane Roseman, Marchin Smee Tana, and Sarojini Nadampally for this insightful conversation. To read Marchin's commentary on the moral frameworks of commercial surrogacy, visit srhm.org. All articles are available online and free of charge. Follow SRHM Journal on social media or sign up for our newsletter to receive notifications for new research. Thank you for supporting the SRHM podcast, which is produced by the SRHM staff. The music was composed by Thibert Christian and Salomon Botond.